Well, praise the Lord. Good to see each one of you this morning and to continue our worship together. I would invite your attention back to the book of Revelation and Revelation 21, chapter 21. It's been a while since, or I feel like it's been a little while since we were walking through this book together. We did enjoy a trip to Thailand and back again since we looked at Revelation 20. I'm not exactly sure how many weeks ago that was, but hopefully our study of Revelation is not too distant in our minds, so we can't pick it right here up in Revelation 21. This morning, we switch gears on the last vision. Remember, there's four visions that John had. The first one was the vision of the church. The second one was the vision of the tribulation. The third one was the vision of Christ's physical return, the consummation, including the millennium. And finally, we're here. And it is the eternal home. A lot has been changing as we go through Revelation and will change. But what we're embarking on now in Revelation 21 and 22 is the eternal final state, the home of the redeemed. The title could be the new heaven part one. I'll probably, Lord willing, finish the book of Revelation in the next message. There will be one more, Revelation 22. So, Revelation 21, the new home part one. Joyce and I celebrated our 27th anniversary in August. And it was just a grand time. We decided to do something different. I don't know if we've ever done this before, but we went into the inner city for about a 24-hour period. And the inner city of Philadelphia is what we chose to do. And it was a great time, a lovely time. We certainly acted probably and felt like teenagers in the inner city. And like aging people often miss, they sometimes don't understand their physical limitations. You ever catch that about aging people? And as you may know, we're 47, or in upper 40s, and our bodies don't quite function like 20-year-olds. And I guess we didn't catch that, didn't realize that. And I don't know if, I mean, I guess I'll expose some of my ignorance. We reserved a hotel right in the inner city, Philadelphia. Looked at a map, did homework, walking distance, pretty much of where we wanted to be. Pulled into the hotel, and they gave me an option of parking on site for like $50-some. Or find another place to park. Didn't realize that. So we did a little bit of homework and quickly discovered we could park about 3 blocks away, save a little bit of money, and use that money at a few other places. And parked our vehicle, walked back to our hotel. And long story short, we had a wonderful time. But we walked and we walked and we walked. And there's one place we really wanted to see, and that was Race Street Pier. Ever been there? Okay, some of you. Wonderful place. If you get to Philly, make sure you take a little time. Go out to Race Street Pier. We were enjoying Race Street Pier. Actually, walking out there, we got stopped. Literally, somebody said, "Stop! The guy in front of you is just ready to propose." And we actually had to stop because the photographer we got a front row seat to a proposal. Anyway, Race Street Pier was just wonderful. This is just about getting dusk. Okay, it's about the end of the day. Remember, we walked through town quite a bit. And we're looking up at the Ben Franklin Bridge. You know what I'm talking about? It is absolutely gorgeous. And we thought, you know what? That would be a neat, really neat place to observe the city from. And some people actually told us that's a great place to walk or whatever. And I thought, you know what? There's a bike rack right here at Race Street Pier, so we could rent bikes and we could bike the bridge. Well, can we do that? We're not quite sure, so we actually did a little investigation. I forget how we got I think we asked someone, trusted his information. You can rent a bike, go across the Ben Franklin Bridge. Now, this is about as good as it can get. And What we didn't realize is that to get on the bridge, you got to bike pretty far west, maybe a couple blocks, get on this long, long, long ramp. Don't forget the Race Street Pier and the Ben Franklin Bridge has quite a bit of an altitude difference. And don't forget, this is at the end of the day, and we weren't stopping for bottled water like we should have been, and we just, I guess our minds weren't quite functioning like 20-year-old minds either. So we got on this ramp to the Ben Franklin Bridge, and it was up, and it was up, and it was up, and the scene was getting better and better and better and better and better and better. And finally, I was about out of gas. Wait, I wonder how my wife, Joyce, is doing. I was leading the way. It didn't take me long to discover that we're not going to make it. So we actually stopped. I'm glad none of you walked by. Well, maybe it would have been, maybe you could have picked us up and maybe you would have had some bottled water. I actually asked somebody, is there any place I can buy water out here? That was a pretty stupid question. And that's not a very nice feeling. We're so close, but yet so far. I finally realized I have one option, one. And that is to get back on my little rented green bike and down about as fast as I can go, get water, and get back up. That's what I chose. I told Joyce to text me every minute about just to make sure everything is good. And I am so glad that there was no radar or speed limits on that downhill bike ride, because I went pretty fast. And I'm not sure if I had all the bike laws down pat in the inner city of Philadelphia, but I did go a couple blocks and found 3 bottles of bottled water, and I made the purchase as quick as I could, looked at my phone and everything was good. She was fine, texts, I don't know how many texts were there, but I knew there was enough of texts that she was good. So I drank some water, and I don't know how, other than to explain a few angels pushing me, went back up and up and up and up and up to the, almost to the entrance of the Ben Franklin Bridge, and then we got rehydrated. And I thought it would be very wise to, I thought 3 bottles of water, one for me, one for Joyce, and one for a little bit of splashing, because I thought that would definitely revive a person. And we got revived. It's amazing what that does. So we got back on our bikes, and you know, the timing was just perfect. We biked out on the Ben Franklin Bridge. I cannot put into words what I felt personally after that second bike ride back up and just looking over the lights were just especially dazzling and brilliant. Even the traffic on the expressway seemed colorful. The lights were kind of dancing off of the river. It was just beautiful. And seriously, we could have stayed out in the Ben Franklin Bridge for probably an hour, just taking it all in. And then the police came and said, hey, we're going to close the gates here, so off you go. And actually, we only had a few minutes, to be honest. Actually, the police gave us a little bit of grace to have a few borrowed minutes to enjoy the scenery. Well, what's the deal with that story? There's several analogies that I could draw from it. The upward climb, the spectacular sight from the Ben Franklin Bridge. I hope you all can take that in sometime. Or maybe you choose the Verrazano in New York City. But there are so many places you can just take in the view of a city that is just, it's breathtaking. Now, really, when you compare Revelation 21, it probably is a very poor analogy. But we're going to talk about a city that will probably make Philadelphia or New York City or Tokyo or wherever you want to go it could make it like a cesspool, if you will, because you know what the cities often are hiding so much filth and so forth in some of the parts of the city. And in fact, they sometimes are a symbol of decay and decadence and immorality, and despite the majestic scenery that they offer. But I'd like to talk about Revelation 21 and just talk about heaven, the eternal home of the redeemed. And brothers and sisters, sometimes I wonder, I really do, are we longing for heaven? May I ask that very personally to you and to myself, are you longing for heaven? Do you want to go? Do you really want to go? Somebody said recently that they believe that a real homesickness for heaven would probably cure most of the things that we struggle with in our pilgrimage. Hebrews 11, you don't have to turn there, but I'm guessing you're familiar with it, about the heroes of faith who died in faith. It says that they confessed that they were strangers and pilgrims on the earth, and they declared plainly that they seek another country, a better country, that is a heavenly country. And God's not ashamed to be called their God, because he prepared for them a city. That's the one Abraham looked for, a city that has foundations, whose builder and maker is God. I'm wondering, and I'm asking the question personally, are we homesick for heaven? Do we really want to go? Are our lives declaring plainly that we want to go? Over the years of the church age, if you go back to Pentecost and follow the church of Jesus Christ through its many different eras and struggles and times of darkness and reformation and persecution, and follow the church of the Lord Jesus, generally speaking, they had a longing for heaven, a longing. You can go to the persecuted church. You've got glimpses of the slaves in the United States. And actually, we are still reaping some of their longing for heaven from the spirituals that some of them produced. But they often have a longing for heaven woven into them. So over the years, I believe there was a general longing. But sometimes in the era of affluence, the longing for heaven recedes. And the price is so high. The price is so high. Often it takes failing health or what have you to get that longing for heaven, because the affluent society offers so much in so many different areas: the lust of the eye, the lust of the flesh, the pride of life, and so on. But I'm hoping that looking at Revelation 21 will, first of all, motivate us to long to go home and recognize that we're definitely not home. Paul made a very interesting comment about his friend Demas. You familiar with that verse? Paul said about Demas, he said, Demas has forsaken me, having loved this present world. And that's what we often wrestle with. The world has so many attractions and so forth. So let's not be Demas's. Let's not be Mark Twain either. I don't know if you enjoy Mark Twain. I kind of enjoy reading his witty comments, but he's actually a dangerous writer. If you didn't know that, he's a very prolific writer, but a very dangerous writer. You know what Mark Twain says about heaven? He says he was indulging in the fact that he would travel. He said, "I have traveled most every place in the world except every." No, he's. How did he say that? "I have traveled almost every." To every place that I want to go, except heaven and hell. He said, "I've never been there." Then he said, real flippantly and cynically, he said, "You can have heaven. Give me Bermuda." I said, wow, that's a pretty strong statement. We'd never say that. Never, never, never. I'd never say that. But back to my statement of my life. What does my life plainly declare? Pilgrim's Progress, John Bunyan, excellent book. He said, Or Bunyan understood something about this longing for heaven when he wrote the allegory. One of the pilgrims was talking to the other pilgrim as they walked this upward, or the pilgrim's progress to the celestial city. One pilgrim one day asked another one, "In what state are you the most vigorous and spiritually alert?" And the other pilgrim said, "Oh, it is when I am thinking of my home in heaven and who will be there." That's what the one pilgrim told the other one. Bunyan must have understood something about being the motivation that comes with heaven. So Revelation 21 is the last of four visions. Like I said, the church age is over. The tribulation period is over. So when we're breaking into this, if you take the book of Revelation in context, church age is over. Tribulation period is over. Christ's second coming is over. That's the rapture and the white horse appearance, unless they're all one. The Armageddon, the battle of Armageddon, that's history. The millennial kingdom that we looked at in Revelation 20, that's history. Satan's last rebellion at the end of the millennium, that's history. The white throne judgment, that's history. Where all sin, rebellion, and everyone that was not found written in the Lamb's Book of Life was sentenced to the lake of fire with the devil, with the Antichrist, and with the false prophet. All that is history. And now, and by the way, heaven and earth fled away. You remember that in Revelation 20? If you're at 21, you can just glance back to 11. It says, earth and heaven fled away from this white throne judgment. And now we come to Revelation 21. And it is the eternal home of the redeemed. And you know what? This is kind of exciting because in our journey through Revelation, there was so much bad news. There was so much judgment. I mean, I don't know about you, but I almost tired of the seals. I almost tired of the vials and the various judgments that we found in Revelation. But don't forget, the Revelation, whether it's the seals, whether it's the tribulation period or whatever it is, reveals Jesus more accurately, I believe, than any book of the Bible, because it's the revelation of Jesus. You want a perfect picture of who Jesus is? Read the book of Revelation, and the guarantee, I will affirm it again from verse 3, that you will get a blessing. So, now we come to Revelation 21, and we're going to skim through this very rapidly, and the first 8 verses are a simple introduction to the new heaven. This is something that is brand new. All the old is gone. It's brand new. Let's read verse 1. It says, "And I saw a new heaven and a new earth. For the first heaven and the first earth were passed away, and there was no more sea." Now, there's so much that I don't understand, and I'm not going to make an attempt to understand, but there's something about all the old is totally gone, and it's all brand new. In fact, we talk about our loved ones dying and going to heaven with Jesus. I really believe they are not in Revelation 21. This is something that's going to happen new. They are in a place that probably reflects Revelation 21, but this is something that is brand new that is going to come down after Revelation 20 is fulfilled. And it's going to be glorious. There's things that I don't understand about heaven and earth, but I do know that there's 3 heavens. The first heaven is what we see. It's the atmosphere, which includes the clouds, where the birds fly and all that. And then you have beyond the atmosphere is the second heaven, known as the stratosphere. That includes all the planets, the moon, the sun, the stars, and everything. And then you finally, biblical term, go to the third heaven, and that's where God dwells. So somehow, the old's gone. I don't know how. Probably it's going to happen really quick, like 2 Peter 3 talks about. But it seemed that there's a brand new heaven that's going to come down out of the third heaven, because it's going to come from heaven down. And like I said, much I don't understand about it. It does say that there was no more sea. I believe that sea tends to depict separation and danger and the unknown peril and so forth and storms. It's going to be all brand new. Verse 2, "I saw the holy city, the new Jerusalem, coming down from God out of heaven, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. And I heard a great voice of heaven saying, behold, the tabernacle of God is with men, and he will dwell with them, and they shall be his people, and God himself shall be with them and be their God. Let me stop there and just to make a few comments. First of all, this holy city, I believe, is going to be the capital of the eternal. Right here. It's the hub, if you will. It's the capital of the eternal. And it's called the New Jerusalem. And Jerusalem always was an icon to the world. Even in the Old Testament, in the church age, which is kind of a mystery, you know, we're living in such a small slice of the big scope in the church age, which is often referred to as a mystery. It may not be the physical Jerusalem as much, although there's stirrings that put our attention there, but I really believe that, in a sense, the church is very like the New Jerusalem or Zion. In the millennium, I believe there's going to be another focus on Jerusalem, where Christ will sit on the throne of David. But here in the eternal state, for some reason, it's called the New Jerusalem, coming down from God out of heaven. But the ultimate utopia, if you will, is in verse 3. It says God's going to be with us. And that's really where it's at, the presence of God, the fellowshipping with God on a personal level. You'll never have to seek God again. He's going to be right there, face to face with Christ my Savior. Oh, what will that be like? In 1 Thessalonians, we talk about the rapture and how that there's going to be a caught up, when the church is going to go up and meet the Lord in the air. That climaxes with, so shall we ever be with the Lord. And I don't know if that just warms your heart or not. You have to experience the pain of separation to really grasp the beauty of fellowship. You know how it is? You just long to be with those that you love. Who do you love? If you love the Lord, you long to be with him. And verse 3, we start that off in the introduction. Number one, get this clear. We're going to be with the Lord. Tabernacle of God is with men. He's going to dwell with us. We'll be his people. And then in verse 4, it gets very personal. And it's drawing a picture of perfection. It says that God shall wipe away all tears from their eyes. There shall be no more death, no sorrow, no crying, no more pain. All that is passed away. Brothers and sisters, imagine you'll never shed one tear of sadness. And I don't know what all of that means when it says God's going to wipe away all the tears from our eyes. But there is such a care and love, and it's so personal that you'll never experience what the result of sin has brought. And every one of those are a result of sin, whether it's death. And you can broaden that to aging and killing and murder, and you can take it to miscarriages and abortion, and you can take how far you want to take that. No more death. That's a result of sin. All that's gone. We talk about victory. We talk about what's at the end of the book. No more sorrow. No sorrow. No disappointments. We live in a world that is just flooded with disappointment. Those that are the closest to us sometimes disappoint us. No more sorrow. We disappoint them. No more. Done. Never again. No more sorrow. No, you'll never feel a twinge of guilt, failure, inadequacy. All those bring sorrow. Never, none, done. Thirdly, no crying. Never. You'll never have the need to shed a tear. Why do we cry? We cry because of pain. We cry because of physical pain. Sometimes we cry more because of emotional pain. We cry. We hurt. We grieve. We live in a fallen world. We live in a broken world. But there's a Redeemer. And no, we're not totally redeemed from all of that. Now we still experience death, sorrow, crying, pain. But this is going to be gone in the eternal state. None. Never. Some of you sitting right here would be much better qualified to speak on this than me. No more pain. Can I name a few people? Sister Sue, Brother Dan, Brother Ed taught our Sunday school class, and somebody just told me that he lives with a lot more pain than he lets on. I'm saying that some of you are so much more qualified to speak about pain. That's physical. And you know what? I think I heard all of them talk about heaven maybe a little bit more than myself. No more disease, no more accidents, no more distress, no more abuse, no more fighting, no more pain. Physical pain hurts, but there's other pains that I think sometimes are so much deeper. It's just the emotional trauma of pain that we experience. No more done. It's all gone. It's all passed away. That's beautiful. You'll never experience it again. Isaiah actually says, you will never remember it, or it will never come to your mind. You can find that in Isaiah 65, verse 17. And you know, the question always often comes up about, well, will we know? What all will we know in the eternal state? I'm not sure. I don't know. But I know one thing. We won't remember any pain, because it says we won't. None of those former things will even come to mind in Isaiah 65. And sometimes we cannot fathom or comprehend all of that, because all we know is earthly, all we know is family relationships, and that's all we know. But when we get to heaven, we are just going to be consumed in the rapture of the beauty of the King and of the Lamb and of all the redeemed, and it is just going to be glorious. What all we know, I don't know, but it's going to be wonderful. The next few verses just give a little bit of assurance. Verses 5 and 6, it says, "And he that sat upon the throne said, Behold, I make all things new. And he said unto me, Write, for these things." And I wonder if John just got all caught up and carried away in what we just read. And then he was reminded, write it down. Because this is true. This is faithful. And then in verse 6, he said to John, "It's done." And I underlined those, I circled all that in my Bible. It is done. It's done. It's all over. It is finished. I am Alpha and Omega, the beginning and the end. So in there, I just see terms of assurance. The voices from the throne, write it down. God's word assures it. The Alpha and Omega simply reflect the sovereignty of God. So I just feel such assurance in those few verses. And now we shift just a little bit to, if I would title verses 6, 7, and 8, is who's there and who's not there. Let's read it. In the middle of verse 6, it says, "I will give unto him that is athirst of the fountain of the water of life freely. He that overcometh shall inherit all things, and I will be his God, and he shall be my son. But the fearful, and the unbelieving, and the abominable, and the murderers, and the whoremongers, and the sorcerers, and the idolaters, and all liars shall have their part in the lake which burns with fire and brimstone, which is the second death." You know, I said there's no more bad news, but I guess you could call that bad news. I just call it a fact. Who's there? I don't know if this is fair, but There's two characteristics of people here. And the first one is, to them that thirst. I don't know if that's fair or not, but the Bible says so much about thirst. Blessed are they that hunger and thirst for righteousness. Isaiah says, "Ho, everyone that thirsts, let him come. Let him come and buy without money, without price." In other words, come to God, come to me. Jesus in John 7 says, "Is anybody thirsty?" Right in the middle of that feast, he says, "Anybody thirsty? Let him come. And if he comes, out of his belly shall flow rivers of living water. This he spake of the Spirit." So there's something about thirsty people that are marked by those that are going to be in heaven. And I don't know what all that implies, but that's the first characteristic that I want to lift out of this text. There's something really neat about thirsting and an intense longing for God and righteousness. Secondly, maybe a little more clear and accurate, is the overcomers. It says, "He that overcometh shall inherit all things." And you know, that's a word that I really think we have to revive. I really think that word overcoming has to be revived. John uses that word so many times. If you read through his epistles in John, and then you come to Revelation, overcoming is into every one of the seven churches, he that overcomes. And now here we find it in the eternal state. It's reminded, those that overcame. And how do we overcome? We overcome him by the blood of the Lamb, and by the word of your testimony, and by the fact that you love not your life until death. So overcoming is a very important characteristic of those that are going to be there. Why this was stuck in here, I'm not sure. I think it's just for a clarification so nobody is deceived. Why in the middle of the eternal state it says, but the fearful won't be there. That's the cowards. That's the ones that won't stand. That's the ones that shirk away, and they're not willing to stand. They're fearful. The fear of man. The unbelieving, and those go hand in hand. You can't be fearful and believing, and you can't be believing and fearful. So it's kind of saying the same thing. The fearful and the unbelieving won't be there. The abominable won't be there. And that word simply means polluted, stained by the filth of the world. They won't be there. It doesn't matter what they may have convinced people in their life. Maybe even public confessions or statements. It says they won't be there. Murderers won't be there. Any disregard for the value of human life, they won't be there. The whoremongers, that's the sexually immoral. Those that don't apply God's standards for sexual morality, they won't be there. Sorcerers won't be there. Practicing any kind of the magic or the devil's power, whether it's for healing or divination or telling the future or putting curses or... They won't be there. And actually, you can broaden that word. The Greek word is pharmakia, which includes the use of drugs. Whoa, that brings on a new... They won't be there. Idolaters. And all those are messages in themselves. You know, an idolater, Bible says covetousness, which is idolatry. So... it's just making it clear that those who practice that lifestyle, that it's a practice, that's their habitual life, they won't be there. That's very clear. And then it goes on, the clincher, I think, is, and all liars. You know, I've always told my children, and I tell anyone, because it's something that I believe so deeply. If you're honest, dad and mom can help. And God can help. If you lie, dad and mom can't help. God can't help. You can correct me if I'm wrong. A prerequisite to help is honesty. Hiding about anything in your life is going to only cause confusion and problems. All liars. And you can really broaden that term. All liars. That's a sobering truth, but don't forget, this is the revelation of Jesus. This reveals Jesus more clearly, probably, than any other book. Now, real quickly, we have to move along. The time is going rapidly. Now we have a, quote, tour guide come along in verse 9 and say, John, come along with me. Let's read it in verse 9. It says, and there came unto me one of the seven angels which had the seven vials full of seven last plagues and talked with me, saying, come hither, I will show thee the bride, the Lamb's wife. And he carried me away in the spirit to a great and high mountain, and he showed me the great city, the holy Jerusalem, descending out of heaven from God. Maybe I'll just stop there, and I don't know if there's a whole lot to explain. What else? I mean, it's interesting that it's one of the angels, one of the same angels that brought the vial judgment. And John recognized that angel, and the angel said, come with me, personal tour. And I don't know what it looked like. I don't know if it was just a picking up off of the rocket at the Isle of Patmos. And I don't know. They went in the spirit. And they came over. They crested this great mountain. And there they beheld it. And it was breathtaking. He tries, the poor man, John, to put it into human words. It's interesting that it says the Lamb's wife. And I know I stopped there for a bit and said, what is that all about? The Lamb's wife is the church. That's obvious from Ephesians 5. But I really believe that this city is characterized by its occupants. And that's why you have that term there of the Lamb's wife. But in verse 11, it says, having the glory of God, and her light was like unto stone, most precious, even like a jasper stone, clear as crystal. And I call this the panoramic verse. It's just like, there it is. It's an overview, if you will. Impossible to put into words. And John just says, the glory of God was all over this city. And I know the hymn writer tried to put it into words when they said, rare jewels of splendor are glowing. How beautiful heaven must be. Another hymn writer said, heaven's really going to shine. Maybe this is a weak analogy, but do you ever go out after an ice storm and the sun rays dance right off of that ice? It's just awesome, especially if you're in a mountain. I mean, you really, really want the ultimate. Go by a creek where there's a few pine trees and there's greenery and there's ice and the sun comes out. It is just like a glistening. It's so beautiful. But that analogy is so weak compared to what it's really going to be. The glory of God is going to be exploding from this beautiful city that we are going to enjoy. God's brilliance was often seen in manifestations of light in the Old Testament, like the burning bush, the pillar of fire, and the Shekinah glory that came out of the tabernacle, but it's going to be glorious. Now let's go a little bit to the architectural beauty in verse 12 to 14. If you're into architecture, structure, here's a little bit of a glimpse. It talks about the wall in verse 12. It was great. It was high. It had 12 gates, and the gates were 12 angels, and names were written on them, which are the names of 12 tribes of the children of Israel. On the east, there were three gates, north, three gates, south, three gates, west, three gates. And the wall of the city had 12 foundations, and in them, the names of the 12 apostles of the Lamb. Again, I don't know if there's much to say other than, did you catch the walls? Did you catch the gates? And did you catch the foundations? So what we have is we have four sides. Every side has three gates with foundations, and every gate has an angel, and every gate has a name of one of the 12 tribes ascribed to it. And then you look underneath on the foundation, you have one of the apostles. And I don't know what all of that means, but it validates the Old Testament and it validates the New Testament, and it's exploding in radiance throughout all of eternity. That's beautiful. Now we have the measurements in verses 15 to 17. And it says, he that talked with me had a golden reed to measure the city and the gates thereof and the walls thereof. And the city lieth foursquare. The length is as large as the breadth. And he measured the city with the reed 12,000 furlongs. And the length and breadth and the height are all equal. And he measured the wall thereof 140 140 and 4 cubits, according to the measure of a man, that is, of the angel. Now, that kind of goes over my head. I wouldn't mind seeing the golden reed that the angel had to measure this kind of measurements, but I don't doubt it for a moment. I believe it's accurate to the millimeter. In summary, all those measurements will give you a cube that is 1,500 miles wide, both ways, and high. You have a cube. Now, to put that into perspective, 1,500 miles is approximately from the tip of Florida to the tip of Maine. So, and really, some believe that this is just the capital city. It does have gates that are never closed. I enjoy people that stretch their imagination a whole lot more than I do. But there are, in fact, Harold Martin, I will quote him. He says, "We might be space travelers that are able to move from galaxy to galaxy at the speed of light. And the New Jerusalem is only the capital city that descends out of the vast space of galaxies. And the angels at the gates, as we go, will welcome us as we go from..." That's beyond any of our minds to comprehend all of that. But we do know that eye hath not seen, ear hath not heard, and it never entered into the heart of man what God has prepared. So there's no possible way that we can put it all into perspective. But don't ever think that heaven will be crowded. Somebody also did some math, and they figured 100 billion people will have existed from Adam to now. And then they speculate that in the millennium there will be equal to that amount because of the perfect environment and the population explosion. Now, that's all speculation. And then if you take a certain portion of that, 25%, if per se 25% would be saved out of those two figures, you're going to have several square miles per person on just the capital. Again, that's all interesting speculation, but the size is given here to us in Revelation 21 for a reason, and I'm not exactly sure why the size is, but the next few verses I'm going to skip over. They're beautiful pictures of building materials in verses 18 to 21. And I was tempted to bring a slide of various speculations of what this might look like. All I'll say is all these colors of these precious stones are just a dazzling array of color that coordinates so beautifully. And they come from the foundation alone, let alone the pure gold content that we don't know anything about. The pure gold that is transparent. It is absolutely beautiful. And in verse 22, it says there's no temple there. So it's going to talk about the worship. And in verse 23, it's talking about the light. Now, don't forget the size of the city, the capital city, 1,500 square mile cube, no light. And you know what? For light illumination, it takes to illuminate 100 or 1,000 square foot room. No light needed. We cannot comprehend the radiance and the light that comes from God. Verses 24 to 26 simply depict that all nations will be there. Every nation, every ethnic group. That word nation is the word ethne, which is every single ethnic group is going to be there. And then it closes with an absolute. And it says, "There shall in no wise enter into it anything that defileth, neither whatsoever worketh abomination and makes a lie, but they that are written in the Lamb's book of life." I think I'll close there and pick up the story of heaven in the next message. Revelation 22 focuses a little more on the provisions that are in heaven and also the final invitation. But there was a swimmer, I don't know if you remember the name Florence Chadwick. She was the first female to swim the English Channel both ways. Pretty incredible swim. One day, she decided to swim from Catalina Island to the shores of, I think it's Los Angeles, 22 miles. she wanted to be the first person to swim from Catalina Island to L.A. So one Saturday, I think it was I forget which day of the week, she went over to Catalina Island, and it was a cloudy, foggy day. Cool, just right. And she swam, and she swam. She swam nonstop for 15 hours. 15 hours. But it was too foggy. She couldn't see. And there was a boat right with her. They encouraged her to keep going, but they couldn't see. Finally, she said, I'm done. I can't. I simply can't. She got in the boat, and the fog lifted. And she was about a half a mile away from shore. If only she could have saw it. And I wonder if that's how it is. You study the Bible in the end times. I don't know why there is so many warnings about overcoming. Maybe, just maybe, this will help us align our focus to where we're going. Heaven's maybe not as much of a destination as it is a motivation. Our destination really is to just be like Jesus and be with God, but the beauties and glories of heaven, maybe there's a little bit of fog in your life. Maybe there's a little bit of fog in my life. Maybe there's some heaven. Why don't we all stand? Closing prayer. I kept you a couple minutes late. And then Zach, if you'll lead us in a song after that. Father in heaven, thank you for your word. It's a treasure. Thank you for the beauty of heaven. We certainly don't deserve it, but you want to give it to us as a loving Father. And we can almost see you just reaching out your arms as we press on the upward way. Father, some of us might be here with a little bit of fog and are tempted to just grow weary in well-doing, give up, yield to temptation, yield to the world. Father in heaven, give us a grace and a stamina with heaven in sight, with your love in sight, with the beauties and the glories of what we just read, to just be motivated to press on and also to care about those that do not have heaven as their home and their hope. Bless us as we depart. In Jesus' name, amen.